financial literacy, and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Raham.
What do I think about money and believe about money and feel about money can be really helpful to start to get curious. And what are the messages that I've received about money? What do I think is true about money? What do I think is good about money, is bad about money? And just getting curious about this is really a way that we can understand more richly ourselves and how we are interacting with others and the assumptions we're bringing to our engagements with others.
Hi, it's Francis. I just wanted to take a minute to thank you for watching this video. If you're catching us on YouTube, please help us help others by clicking like, subscribe, and all notifications so you don't miss any videos. And check back for the next video. I think you're going to love it. Thanks again. For more information, you can visit us at hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome to Financial Fitness. I'm Jay Dean, along with the Money Doctor, Francis Raham. Hello, we have a guest.
We have a lovely guest. We have Joy Slabaugh with us again. Joy is especially interesting to me as a guest because she's a licensed therapist and a former CFP and the creator of Relational Wealth Framework. That, you know, how many times have people asked me, you know, are you half marriage coach and half financial coach, right? But that to me is very interesting. So, you know, we're going to get all touchy-feely about money and talk about the emotional root of financial decisions, all the stuff that really hamstrings us when we're making financial choices. So she describes her work as living at the intersection of wealth, well-being, and impact, which I think is incredibly accurate. So welcome, Joy, back to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor.
Thank you so much for having me back. I really appreciate it.
Our pleasure, our pleasure. Let's talk first about the relational wealth framework. You coined that phrase. Can you teach us what that means?
Yeah, I really think of this as about our relationship with money and how money impacts our relationships with others. So I think of it as there's an internal relationship, how we think about our money, and then there's our relationship externally with others and the way money impacts that. So I really think about this as inviting people to think, to consider both sides of this. And as we do that, this is really where we can start to see shifts in our relationship with money and how it impacts others. And that's where we get to experience more connection, more authentic connection with others, and a more impactful life as well.
That word relationship. I think in the forward to one of my books, Chris Collins, actually, who's no longer with us, a great guy, but he had written the forward and he said, when did my love-hate relationship with money begin?
Yeah, well, we live in a capitalistic culture where money makes the world go round and money impacts all of us, whether we realize it or not. And so this relationship with money is sometimes one we're not aware of, that we don't even think about what money means to us and how we feel about money. Or it can be a very intentional one where we become aware of how we think and feel about money and our attitudes toward money. So again, whether we're aware of it or not, we all have a relationship with money. Because we live in the culture that we do and we grew up in the family, whatever family we grew up with, we tend to absorb beliefs and attitudes from what's around us. And so this can really shape our relationship with money in ways we may or may not be aware of. And so this can be a positive or it can be a negative or something in between as well. And so what I find just really fascinating is the way money impacts us and our attitudes and what and our values. And I really can talk about this all day long with people because it's just so interesting to me. And so again, I refer to it as a relationship with money, but it's like everything that we think and feel around money. So like an example for me is that one of my values around money is, to me, it represents safety and security. I find when I chat with people, we all have different money values. Oftentimes when you talk with people, it's either safety and security, or it is about freedom and independence, or it is about connection with friends and family, or some combination of this. And the safety and security one is really, really strong with me. And that has had a lot of impact and influences on how I live my life and how I engage with money. And that this used to be something that I was not really aware of. I just kind of did my thing. And I was like, yeah, I'm somebody who really values saving, right? And then it was only as I got more curious and deeper into my own relationship with money when I realized, oh, actually, I'm treating money as a source of safety and security. So it can feel really threatening to me if I need to spend more money than I had planned. And that can feel really stressful for me. And it's not just because I'm spending more money, it's because my sense of safety and security is being eroded. So I give that as an example about how our relationship with money, whether we're aware of it or not, really can impact us in a lot of ways. And as we become aware of it, it opens up more possibilities of how we can be in this relationship and thus exist in the world.
You know, this thing with money and relationships is always interesting. All those hidden beliefs that get us, you know, I like to call it baggage. It's probably not the technical term, right? But can you give us an example of maybe a couple that you, obviously not with names, but a couple that, you know, maybe one person has one set of beliefs, another person has another set, they're on completely different pages.
Yeah. Something that's really common with couples is where you often see different values is one really values saving and one really values spending. And it's really easy for these couples to end up in at, you know, loggerheads with each other,
Yes.
demonizing the other of like, oh, you're a spendthrift who doesn't care about the future, you know, and then the other one's like, well, you're a tightwad who doesn't want to have any fun, right? I'm sure you all have heard this with your own partner or friends or your parents, right?
No, never.
Right. We've heard, we know how this plays out.
Sure.
And one of the things that we is often overlooked with this is realizing that this is just about values, money values, and one is not good or bad. They're just different. And when we go a little bit deeper with people, we often find that the person who's wanting to spend is really trying to help the couple, their family, live life in the moment and not be so future oriented that they can't enjoy the present. And you find we'll find that the saver is really trying to shore up security in the future, right? That we can have fun in the future as well. And so when we help people get down to their core values, it's a lot easier to appreciate what the other is bringing. Well, you're of course, like I tend to be the saver person, right? When I hear that the other person is about enjoying the present, wow, that really resonates with me. And like, I really appreciate that. That's a huge value add for me that they're helping me enjoy the present, right? And then what I bring is, okay, yeah, we can plan and think for save for the future, can make sure that we're going to be okay in the future. They can bring that, I'm bringing that value add of security and stability. And so this it can really take what is often a hot button topic that people fight about with their couples therapist, with their financial advisor, with each other, with the kids, right? All the time. It can actually be an opportunity for closer connection with each other. And so money really can invite us to deeper connections with each other. And understanding our own values and appreciating the values of others is a path toward that deeper connection.
We
It's funny,
definitely.
Francis. I never thought about the fact that, you know, you want help with your money, but you also want help with getting along and how the two, you know, coexist or need it. You know, you may need help with both. It's a whole new business model. Joy's got it down. Do you need help with your money or do you need help with therapy? You know,
Well, the
proven.
thing is that money problems show up in your relationship. And so that's where, for us, I mean, how long have we been talking about this exact thing? That's why I like to have Joy on as a guest, because she says all the things that we deal with. She says them very eloquently and from a professional standpoint, right? But one ends up being the steward of household finances. They're the one that pays the bills and handles the minutiae, and that's their role in that relationship. And the other one often will hand over a paycheck and say, "Honey, you're doing a great job. I'll see you at retirement," right? When there's a stressor that's introduced, a kid has to go to college, you know, somebody loses their job, somebody's sick, then this all just bubbles to the surface and people start pointing their fingers at each other. So one of these partners feels like they have a handle on where the money's going, but they're frustrated because they can't fix the problem. And they go to the other partner and say, "We need to talk." Those terrible words, right? We need to talk. And worse than that, it's about money. And so now the sparks fly. And now the other person is feeling awful because they don't know how to solve it. They've been living in a bubble, right? They have no idea that you're just not on the same page. As often as I use that phrase, we find for the most part, it's just about doing exactly what Joy just said. Just address get to the core of it, figure out what each person really does want, compliment them, right? That they're both trying to do the same thing. They're living in the same household, they're on the same team. And if one of them's pulling this way and one of them's pulling that way, their wagon isn't going anywhere. So when you get them together, then everything seems to get easier, and the positive reinforcement goes a long way.
I think that's really nicely said. And it's reminding me of another type of situation where you see different money values in couples. And that's often where you see class differences. So maybe one person grew up working class and the other person grew up in an upper middle class family. Often they have very different attitudes toward money and very different ways of treating it. And I've seen all different versions of this, but this can be one that leads to so much conflict because each person grew up in one world around money. And we often tend to think that, well, of course, everyone thinks about it this way, right? But that's not as we know, that's not actually the case. And so it can really lead to a lot of conflict when it's really much bigger than even just the individual, right? There are class-based attitudes toward wealth that can influence us, and expectations around money and expectations around lifestyle. And so all of these things can be influencing the individual and influencing the couple and influencing their relationship in ways they may not even be aware of. And so this is where the getting curious with ourselves about what do I think about money and believe about money and feel about money can be really helpful. To start to get curious, and what are the messages that I've received about money? What do I think is true about money? What do I think is good about money? Is bad about money? And just getting curious about this is really a way that we can understand more richly ourselves and how we are interacting with others and the assumptions we're bringing to our engagements with others.
What do
I
you
don't know about you, Francis, but I am learning a lot here for sure. And I'm sure people have questions, but Francis, can we get your phone number?
Of course, it's 413-773-3333.
And of course, as always, go to hugyourmoney.com. We will be back with more of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Francis Ram.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is underwritten by Franklin County Technical School. We build futures. Visit fcts.us or call 413-863-9561.
Welcome back to Financial Fitness. I'm Jay Dean, along with the Money Doctor, Francis Ram, and our guest, Joy. It's a joy to have Joy on.
Welcome back, Joy. So picking up on this relationship thing again, everybody wants to blame their parents. Why didn't my parents teach me about money? Why did my parents teach me awful things about money? How much of an effect do you think that plays in the way that we grow up thinking about money and how difficult it is for us to change our habits based on what we learned from our parents?
Well, this is an age-old debate in the psychology field about nature versus nurture.
Yes.
And the reality is it's both. That yes, the things our parents do and say and we witness does influence us, and it's also not permanent. That we have agency, and so we can adjust these messages. And our brains are not necessarily, they don't have to be set. We can cultivate neuroplasticity, which is what allows us to form new beliefs and attitudes. So I want to offer that as hope to anyone who's maybe you recognize that your family relationship with money was kind of warped. It doesn't have to stay that way. There are ways that you can evolve this and grow and evolve and change. You're laughing.
I love that you used warped as a
Well,
professional.
it's a good word.
That their relationship with money was kind of warped. That brings me to a question. You are a rare combination of a therapist and a financial professional. How did that happen? There's got to be a story there, Joy.
Yeah, so I was a financial planner. I got into financial planning right after college, and I really loved it because you get to work with people. It's a lot of creative problem solving and a healthy dose of nerdy analytics, which I love. And so I thought this is the perfect career, and it was in a lot of ways. And I went on to work with extraordinarily wealthy individuals doing really fascinating, intellectually engaging work. And I also noticed that while I was helping people solve some problems, it was sometimes also creating other problems. And that it wasn't the magical cure-all. Like financial planning, I was like, okay, yes, we have their money in order, but sometimes they're still really unhappy. Sometimes they still really feel anxious or feel all sorts of ways. And so I got really curious about, could there be more? And, you know, essentially my job was to help wealthy people acquire more money. And I was like, there's got to be more to life than this. And so I, after a lot of introspection, decided to make a career change to become a therapist, specifically a trauma therapist, which is incredibly meaningful and rewarding work. And I really love this work. What I was really surprised, though, was that people were still talking to me about money. And I was like, no, I'm a therapist now. I'm not a financial planner now. And they're still talking about money. And I realized that, you know, yeah, money does bring up a lot of emotions. I'd seen that as a financial advisor, was surprised to hear it coming in with my therapy clients. At first, I was surprised. But then as I thought about it more, I was like, well, of course, where else are people going to talk about money? A lot of therapists don't like talking about money. Financial planners, a lot of them don't like talking about emotions. So for many people, there's this big question mark of where and how do I get some support navigating all these ways that money is impacting me? And so that's what then inspired me to move into the intersection of money and well-being and emotions and our psychology. And I really love this because now I feel like this work, I still sometimes do work with extraordinarily wealthy people. And I feel like I have an opportunity to help them transform their relationship with money, where they get to shift it from one of stress and isolation and help evolve it so it's a tool for connection, impact, and lasting fulfillment. And to me, this feels like a life well lived. So this is me bringing my life in alignment with my values.
I totally agree.
Joy, when you said people, it seems to me, let me put it this way, that people who have a lot more money would automatically be kind of channeled to a way to figure out how to make it work. I mean, are there people with a lot of money? It's just willy-nilly and they don't, you know, there's another professional phrase, willy-nilly.
Well, I mean, there's the financial aspect and the math and do you have your ducks in a row financially? There's that piece. But then there's this piece of imagine someone who builds a gazillion-dollar business, and this is their life's work. They've poured blood, sweat, and tears into this, all of their life into this. And then they got that big buyout, private equity bought it, and they got the giant payout and the big paycheck. And now, after they've sold it, they realize that was their entire identity. And who are they now? Mm-hmm. They don't have this business. They're not building a business any longer. Who are they now? And that can actually be really disorienting for people. And where they're really questioning who they are and what they're doing. I know someone who was so impacted by the equity, by the sale of their company early. They were, you know, pretty lucky that they built a really successful firm, got a buyout, and they felt adrift. And then they spent 20 years trying to figure things out, and they eventually built a new company to compete with the one that they'd sold and get a second go at it. But I share this to say that like we like to think that money is going to solve our problems, and it will solve some problems. I don't want to pretend otherwise, but it also can create some problems, and it can also mask other problems that when we might not realize that, oh, I'm not super clear on who I am and what my meaning is in life is because I'm so focused on amassing wealth. And then once we stop doing that or there's a big event in our life, then that's gone. And now it's like, wait, what am I doing? Who am I? What actually matters to me? And those can be really uncomfortable questions to ask and can bring up really uncomfortable emotions.
Yeah, I think the masking point is really great because when I have clients who are very wealthy, they often think, I have enough money. All I need to talk to you about is, am I making enough money? You know, am I protecting my assets? Am I making enough money? What do I do if I want to leave it to somebody? How do I tick all the boxes? Do I need a trust? Very specific monetary questions. But in reality, I find that those are the people that very often, especially if they've inherited the money, if they haven't built it from the ground up, that very often aren't really in touch with their own values. When I start asking questions like, what's important to you about this? I get answers like, well, I saw this guy who told me I should have whatever. That's not the answer to the question I asked, right? So but it is very rewarding when you can do that, when you can draw somebody out and figure out what they want. You call it wealth alignment. And I think that's a really good term to sort of align people's values with their money. And I want you to talk a little bit more about that. But I just wanted to bring up one thing about business people who grow a business and then do something else with it and lose their identity in the mix. And one of the things that I see that's really difficult for families, and I'd love to get your take on it, is they grow a business from the ground up. They have some children. They want the business to go to the children, and they do. And the children don't really want the business. And maybe they haven't said they don't want the business, or they want it, but their perception about what they want is skewed. They think they're just getting, this great thing that makes money, a license to print money. And in fact, they have to learn how to run this business. And I have this discussion with my business people who have that on their agenda, and say, can you get your kids to help run it? Can you teach them how to work it? But it's almost impossible, if I find that those parents who had nothing in the beginning and have now amassed this wealth, all they want to do for their kids is not have their kids have to struggle. They just want to give them stuff. And it seems to have a counterintuitive effect in the end. Can you, maybe you disagree, but can you talk to me about that?
No,
Tell us about it.
I very much agree with you. There's actually a book I'm finishing up reading right now that talks to this exactly around how wealthy parents, the way they tend to parent and the way money enables them to parent, actually can end up harming the psychological development of their children. And that the children of affluent families have higher rates of anxiety and depression than any other socioeconomic class. So there's a couple things with what you shared. Part of it is when we, as parents, of course, don't want our children to suffer. And yet that is part of life, and learning how to tolerate discomfort is part of developing what's required to develop emotional regulation so we can be well-adjusted adults that can interact with other people in harmonious ways. When we interrupt that process in our children, it's often because it's really uncomfortable for us to watch them suffer or watch them struggle. And when we have vast resources, we really can throw money at every problem, not realizing that it might be creating problems for our children down the road. So that's one piece of what you mentioned. And the other piece of what you're talking about is this idea of the parents have the dream, they built the business, and then they want to keep it in the family and pass it down. And the second and third generation may have varying levels of interest and desire to be involved in the business. And I think to me, this really illustrates the point about money values. We all have values around money, and they're often different. And in the example you shared, right, these are parents who have this value of really want to provide for my family, want there to be this legacy. That's their value. Is that the value of their children, the next generation? Maybe, but maybe not. And that's where I feel we sometimes see this. Just a second. That's sometimes where we see this going a bit sideways, is one generation is assuming that the next generation has the same values. And many times they don't. They're different people and they have a different gender, cultural influences. There's a lot of things that can change from one generation to the next. And so, what can be really valuable for families like this is to have conversations around their values. And their advisor or someone else can create a space for them to each talk about what their values are. And they can then appreciate each other's values and realize that collectively, this actually is enriching the family with these different perspectives. And it's okay that we can have different values. That doesn't mean one person is good and one person is bad. It's just different attitudes and values around money.
I totally agree with you on that. I noticed that when you were talking about this is a little personal, but I always get a little personal with people I like. I noticed that when you were talking about, as a parent, you have children, you had almost a visceral response. Did something come to mind, a story or something that that crossed your mind that you might be able to share with us?
Yeah, I just a couple things. I am really curious about what makes people tick and why are people the way they are. And I think where this really resonates with me is I often work with people who are the product of wealthy parents throwing money at the problem to solve things. And I see what that does to people. And I see the ways where people can really end up struggling in ways that might be surprising, honestly, and the way it can impact people's ability to regulate their emotions. And thus, when we're not able to regulate our emotions, life is just a lot more painful and uncomfortable, honestly. And so, honestly, I feel some sadness and sorrow realizing that for a lot of wealthy parents, in their effort to protect their children from pain and discomfort and throwing money at these problems, they are actually creating a life that is likely to be more emotionally uncomfortable than it needs to be. And it's this really just cruel catch 22, if you will, of the way what we want versus how things actually play out.
Yeah, life is terribly unfair in a lot of ways. And that's one of them. I mean, the storybooks tell us if we just make good, we can make the next generation happier and healthier, and they will be grateful and do it again and again and again. But I think any sort of relationship comes with all its complexities. And when you add money to the equation, everything amplifies for whatever reason. I mean, you can say, well, it's just money, but just money causes a lot of problems. I talk about it being the third person in a relationship. There's you, there's your partner, and there's money. And you each have a relationship with that third person, and it's money. Just give it a name and acknowledge it and figure out what you're going to do to keep it from rearing its ugly head when you don't want it to, and to play nicely with you.
That's a really great, I really like that approach, actually. Like, that's a really great idea to bring some playfulness and fun to this and take this unspoken thing, the third person in the relationship being money, and make it actually spoken. And I love your idea of give it a name. I don't know, what do you
Thanks.
call it?
The money,
Clementine? Like,
we call it the money monster.
love that, the
Money
money
monster.
monster. Right, that then we can have a little humor around it, which humor is something that can make painful topics a little bit easier sometimes. And also, it then helps creates an opportunity for people to shift from seeing their partner as the other or the problem to, no, this is the money monster. And we can be aligned as a team, corralling the money monster, if you will. So I love that approach that you mentioned.
Well, thanks. I've actually had people write to me and say, my money monster needs an appointment.
I love it.
We'll be sure to share your resources and let people know how they can connect with you and your work. But thank you once again for joining us, Joy.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you,
Our
Joy.
pleasure.
Francis, can we get your phone number one more
Of
time?
course. 413-773-3333.
And as always, hugyourmoney.com is a great resource too. Join us again next time for another edition of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Francis Rand.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is underwritten by
Hug Your Money. It's where you belong. Your future's waiting, steady and strong. Dignity shines in the smallest dream. Permission granted to chase your dream.
Will you help us spread the word about financial fitness? Please like, subscribe, and choose all. Thank you.
Financial literacy and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Raham.
And we have a very special guest joining us today, Dr. Alex.
I like when we call him Dr. Alex. It's so casual.
Yeah.
We're cool.
We could call him McDreamy or McSteamy, but I didn't know if he would find that appropriate or not.
Hi, it's Francis. I just wanted to take a minute to thank you for watching this video. If you're catching us on YouTube, please help us help others by clicking like, subscribe, and all notifications so you don't miss any videos. And check back for the next video. I think you're going to love it. Thanks again. For more information, you can visit us at hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the money doctor, Dr. Francis Ram. Hi.
Hi, Jess. How are you?
I am doing great, and we have a guest joining us today.
We do. We have joining us today Dr. Alexander, or Alex, Kucherov. He's double board certified in reproductive endocrinology and infertility and obstetrics and gynecology at Allume Fertility. Wow, that's a mouthful. Mm-hmm. He's helped countless individuals and couples navigate the complex and emotional journey of family building, not to mention the expense, which is why he's here today in part. But we're going to talk about the whole gamut. He's done it all with warmth, science, and compassion. So whether you're planning ahead or struggling to conceive, Dr. Kucherov probably brings real-world insight for you into fertility and the care and the hope that comes with it. So welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor. Doctor. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Francis, for that amazing introduction. I appreciate it. Happy to be here.
Oh, it's our pleasure. So, you know, I think people tend to think of, you know, somebody who's a doctor who's dealing with these kinds of scientific and very complex issues as maybe a little stoic or maybe even heartless. But I believe that your journey actually is why you are this way. Do you mind talking about why you approach it in this way? Do you mind talking about your personal journey here? It's pretty sensitive, but will you tell us?
Sure. Yeah, I'm happy to get into it. I mean, I decided to do this as a specialty before attempting to build my family. I really enjoyed my endocrinology and reproductive medicine courses in medical school, and I did an OBGYN residency. And it was during that time I really decided that this is what I wanted to focus on, was fertility and family building. And so I went into my fellowship for reproductive endocrinology and fertility before building a family, and got married around that time. And we tried to start building our family for about a year, and actually had infertility as a couple. And because this is what I did, I decided to do an evaluation, a fertility evaluation for myself and my wife. And she's happy with me talking about this, by the way. I've talked to other people about this. The only thing that we found is that she was having basically longer menstrual cycles than typical, ovulating a little bit irregularly. And in that situation, the first line strategy is typically oral medication, just pills, to try to make the menstrual cycle happen a little bit more regularly, a little bit more obvious when ovulation is happening. We can do monitoring of the ovulation cycle in the office to make sure we know, you know, exactly when to have intercourse. And that worked, basically.
I'm really glad that you said, before you told us all of these details, that your wife was fine with this and you talked to her.
Yes.
Okay, so Dr. Alex, so this ended up working for you, being able to kind of regulate that. But when you were going into it, were there myths that you had heard about? I mean, obviously, being a doctor, you had more information, but about male versus female infertility issues?
I think one of the common myths out there is that fertility is a strictly female issue, mm-hmm. and that it is quite rare. And, you know, many of us go through our whole lives, especially women, being told, like, try to prevent pregnancy. don't let it happen. But when you're ready for it, hey, it'll just kind of happen. And that's kind of the end of it. For a lot of people, that's not true. First of all, about a third of male-female couples, there is a male factor in fertility, a sperm issue of some kind. Whether that's something that is intrinsic to the male partner, whether that's something that is caused exogenously. So for instance, taking testosterone supplements or things like that, there are lots of different things that can affect the sperm. And many times there's not obvious reason why the sperm might be affected. So yes, about a third of couples have some component of male factor infertility, which is a lot of people. The other major myth is that infertility is rare. Totally not true. About 12% of couples in the world are affected by fertility challenges. That is a lot of people, 12% of couples. And so quite common. And one of the biggest reasons it's becoming more common is that people are waiting longer to begin their families.
Right.
Back in the olden days, early 1900s, people, were married in their late teens, early 20s, and having kids very quickly and very early. And a lot of the issues that we see now around fertility really didn't come up. Some of them did, and they didn't know how to handle them appropriately. But some of the
Yeah.
things we see now, lower egg numbers as we go on in life, lower egg quality, certain sperm issues, other things related to general health that can affect fertility, weren't issues because people were building their families earlier. Nowadays, people are waiting longer, appropriately building their careers, living the lives they want to lead. But it's becoming more of an issue.
I have two different friends too, and I'm wondering if you know any statistics or data on this that got pregnant really easily with the first baby, but they were trying to add, like 2 years later, a sibling, and they just could not get pregnant the second time and really didn't understand it and were really struggling with that. Is that common?
Yes. So primary, which means primary infertility versus secondary infertility are two pretty separate entities. And
Okay.
often have different causes for them. Secondary infertility, which means you've gotten pregnant in the past or perhaps have had a baby in the past, and now we're trying to continue to build your family, quite common. I see plenty of folks who, again, often going back to age issues, may have had their first baby when they were maybe 30 or 31, 32, maybe another one at kind of 33, 34, 35, and now maybe 37, 38, looking for baby number three. Just as an example, there's a huge difference between even 35 and 38 in terms of egg quality. As an example, at age 35, you'd expect about two-thirds of embryos that you form when adding sperm to be genetically chromosomally normal. At 38, it goes down to half. At
Wow.
age 40, it's now about 40% of embryos are normal. 41, it's about 25%.
Wow.
And see how things change really quickly. So that is, it's quite common to see that. Absolutely.
I'm sure that Illume handles this, holistically and provides support around all of these different areas, including financial, which of course we'll talk about. But what do you do, particularly, I wouldn't say particularly for men, but there must be a pride factor. There's some psychology going on here about why, who's broken and why, and how can you fix it? And then all of that must come into play. I'm thinking of the old days when people used to just say that the wife was too uptight, and if she just relaxed, they'd have babies, right? I'm hoping we're much
You wouldn't
further
believe
along
how
than that.
often I hear that still. Oh, my
No.
auntie just said, just relax and it'll happen. That's a great one, a classic. That's an oldie but goodie. Unbelievable. But it's there. You're correct. It's there in the culture. And different cultures, feel differently about different things, etc. But you're correct in the sense that there is still sometimes a perception from men that like, oh, this is her problem, which is totally inappropriate, I would say.
I bet
However,
that doesn't help.
it doesn't help. I am reassured by a lot of the couples, the male female couples I meet, where men are often actually quite plugged in to this process and are very happy to do whatever needs to be done to build their families. And it's actually quite reassuring. I don't even when I started, really practicing OBGYN about 15 years ago now. It was not really the vibes I was getting at the time from a lot of people. So I think maybe some things have changed. So I would say overall, most of the men I meet are actually pretty plugged in and ready to roll.
I'm just curious, especially when you were talking about how the numbers, I guess, of viable embryos, is that how you put it, like drop so drastically as you get a little bit older. Do you recommend people taking on the expense of freezing their eggs at a certain age then if they plan on having kids?
I absolutely recommend, if you can, to do some kind of fertility preservation. If you feel like you're not going to be ready to begin to build your family by your early 30s, let's say 31, 32, 33, if you're kind of around that age and haven't started building your family, haven't really, or don't have any plans to, but kind of want to keep that door open, that is really the end of the peak of your kind of fertility powers for your whole life, is kind of the early 30s. It starts to change a bit in your kind of 35, 36, and then it changes very quickly at 37. I mean, really, at 37, every year after that is a huge difference, not just in terms of egg numbers, which also go down over time, unfortunately, but also the egg quality. There's a major difference. So yes, if you are in your early 30s and have not considered freezing eggs, I would absolutely recommend it around that time if you can. And there are different ways to do it, a different, we talk about this, but different financing options, et cetera, if there's no employer coverage. Most employers do not cover elective, what we'd call elective egg freezing. Some do, and there are certain plans that do, but unfortunately, many do not at this time.
But I know from our conversation before we get on the air that there are options, and I promise we're going to talk about that in length in the second half. But just before we go to break, can you talk a little bit about how cultures are different when it comes to fertility?
I think I've seen the gamut of how people approach fertility as something to be addressed or not addressed. And there are certain situations from anybody where people are kind of in denial about it. I have seen it more for men than for women, but I mostly see women in my practice because I'm an OBGYN. But again, this is something that I think has changed, at least in my experience. Like the folks that I'm seeing now, certainly in my practice, folks are usually coming to the practice together, and want to be evaluated together. There are certainly some circumstances, and I used to see this again more in the past, but less now, where I'll see a female patient and she'll say, I don't really want to involve my male partner now. I kind of want to get checked out, is one way to say that. Make sure that I'm okay. And then I'll involve him as though the male partner is like a secondary thing. But it's in my opinion, it's kind of sad that folks would feel like they need to be like, well, I did all of my testing and they didn't find anything wrong, in quotes. So now it's your turn, versus like, we're kind of in this together and let's figure it out. And it's honestly, it's a much less efficient way to go about finding out what's going on if you evaluate one person and have to wait and do all the testing, okay, and then we get the other partner in. It's like, we would rather just do everything all together. Let's get it figured out and get going, you know?
Yeah, and I think we probably want to know that both partners are interested in raising a family or having a family and starting a family. So anyway, I think this is a really interesting conversation, and I'm glad we're having it. And I'm glad that you're able to explain things in such accessible terms. So I'm going to challenge you when we come back to start explaining how we're going to afford this fertility trip, given what insurance offers these days. And I know that you know your way through these waters. So I just want to thank you and prepare people when we come back. We will be talking about money and more on about infertility and the treatment of it with Dr.
All right.
Kucherov.
In the meantime, can I get your phone number, Francis?
Of course, Jess, 413-773-3333.
And you can go to hugyourmoney.com. We'll be back with part two of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram, right here on WHMP.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is underwritten by Franklin County Technical School. We build futures. Visit fcts.us or call 413-863-9561.
Welcome back to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram, and we have a very special guest joining us today, Dr. Alex.
I like when we call him Dr. Alex. It's so casual.
We're cool.
We could call him McDreamy or McSteamy, but I didn't know if he would find that appropriate or not. I think he's blushing.
My wife would love it.
I think I love your wife. Okay. All right. So I promised before the break that we would talk about money. Arg, money and infertility. Expensive stuff, right?
In our practice especially, we take it very seriously. We have every patient that comes into our practice gets their own finance and insurance advocate who's really dedicated to that patient and helps them kind of navigate the journey of, unfortunately, dealing with insurance companies and benefits, making sure that we have a direct communication with them and that the patient really understands everything that goes into it. You're right, it is very complicated. A lot of it is based on, in this country especially, employer-based benefits. Which company they work with, what those specific benefits are. A lot of it has to do with what state you live in, because every state is different about what they mandate or don't mandate the commercial insurance companies provide. Every state also has different rules regarding public insurance, Medicaid, et cetera, and what they may or may not cover. It's a very complicated world, but we're happy to jump into it and see.
I can
Okay.
imagine it's got to be hard to navigate too. Like, okay, you've got the pressure of wanting to get pregnant so badly, but then also the pressure of it's costing so much every time you have the treatment. So the pressure of not having to go through that two or three times financially as well. How do you balance that?
It's difficult. I think, as you're alluding to, it's very, very difficult. As from a medical standpoint, unfortunately, we have to be acutely aware of what the coverage is for folks. So as an example, so every insurance company is different, but I have there's one insurance company that we work with that they you can that they will cover four attempts of fertility treatment. And they make no distinction between the absolute lowest level of fertility treatment, which is like oral medicine, versus IVF. They make no
Oh
distinction
boy.
between the things. You get four attempts at whatever it is.
Oh.
There's even caveats to that, whereas some insurance plans say, okay, you get four attempts at this, you get three of this, you get two of this.
Yeah.
Some have no limits at all, and some have even more complicated plans. So yes, it's very, very complicated. But we have a whole, we, I mean, in fertility groups generally have finance folks to help navigate this.
Don't you love those little cuties, insurance companies? Oh boy. So I was really happy when you said they'll pay for four attempts until you said that they don't differentiate between the kinds of attempts. So are there grants available to help people have children, and how does that work?
Yeah, so there are many groups out there, typically nonprofit groups, that if there are financial challenges, can help folks. So, for example, in our practice, there's a grant called Nest Egg, which is very, they all have very cute names, a lot of these grants. So there's Nest Egg, and these are for folks that are, there's various, it's typically specific criteria, but you can get financial assistance for fertility treatment.
Yeah.
There are grants I know out there for folks that have experienced recurrent pregnancy losses to get fertility treatment. There are often cultural and religious based fertility grant options. I certainly know that for the Jewish community, there are grants out there on a local and national basis to help pay for fertility treatment as well.
That's great. But wait, there's more. What else can
Well,
you tell us about money?
so there are plenty of companies that fertility groups work with to help fund fertility treatment. So, for example, our group works with a company called Sunfish. Again, a very cute name. That has grants and loans and different packages to help navigate fertility costs. So, for example, if you were to do self-pay for a fertility treatment cycle, in our practice, you have to pay basically everything up front in order to be able to do it. Whereas with this, third party, you can pay them over time, and then they will pay us to cover everything, which is really nice.
It is really nice. Yeah.
All kinds of different options from that standpoint. So I'd recommend talking to the fertility group that you're working with to see what kind of options there are that are available.
Yeah, I think it's really important to not just say, well, we can't afford it. It's one thing to not be able to afford to care for your family. It's another to not be able to afford to start your family.
The one other thing I would suggest is that check with your employer about what the coverage is. Certainly in many states there are mandates now for fertility coverage. Often it has to do often small employers, so under 100 employees, those types of insurance plans are not necessarily required to cover fertility diagnosis and treatment, but the larger companies may be required to do that. And within even the company, there might be multiple different plans that are available to you. There are on the health insurance exchanges, there are also insurance plans that you can buy that do cover fertility. I certainly know that in New York and Connecticut, the top tier, the gold and platinum plans, you have to kind of dig for them. And you may have to call the insurance company because they don't post totally everything on those marketplaces. But many of them do cover fertility coverage, do cover fertility treatment. And although it might be more on a month-to-month basis than some of the lower level plans, over time you will actually save money because of, unfortunately, how expensive fertility treatment can be.
Yeah, now you're in my camp. Oh, I'm sorry, Jess. Go
That's
ahead.
okay. Is this something where, Francis, how you can do the coverage for most works where you don't pay taxes, like if you put so much aside for health,
Oh, a flex plan? A
a
flex
flat,
plan?
yes. Yes, I'm wondering if you Would this fall under that?
Yes, you can absolutely use HSA accounts and that type of thing to pay for fertility treatment. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, but he said something more interesting to me than that as a problem solver about money. And it was the tip, the hint that, first of all, you need to be proactive and check on your insurance and be an advocate for yourself and say, does my plan cover this? How can I get a plan that covers this? But there was yet another little thing in there where people are considering, you know, they'll change jobs because this plan has a, this company offers a 401k or this company offers that. If you're thinking of changing your job, this is a question you might want to ask going in. What's your coverage for infertility? Are you more than 100 employees? Can I talk to your health company? How can I find out? Because this is really worth some dollars to you if you need this kind of care. What about, I mean, there's no more pre-existing coverage, pre-existing condition problem with coverage, thank goodness. So do they try to get around it with infertility and say you've tried before? Well, how sneaky are these little insurance companies when you're trying to get them to pay for this stuff?
So there's two major situations where there could be issues sometimes getting coverage. The first one is related to the definition of infertility, and specifically, I mean the definition of infertility is really for a heterosexual male-female couple. Important to make that distinction for what I'm about to say. Basically, trying to conceive for a year under age 35, with unprotected intercourse, basically. Above age 35, basically 6 months. Above age 40, the definition is a little bit nebulous. You could kind of make the argument you should do fertility treatment immediately, if you're over age 40 because of those egg quality issues we talked about before. So that's one thing. If you're in a situation where kind of you're 33, you've been trying for 6 months, there's no obvious thing going on. There's no like, you know, it's different if you're like, well, you know, I'm 33, I've been trying for 6 months, but I had ruptured appendicitis. And they had to do surgery and you know, et cetera. You might think maybe the tubes might be injured from that. That's a different story. But like nothing obvious going on, they might say, like, hey, you have to try for a year before we're gonna cover any of this. The
I'm
other
wondering who's
situation.
monitoring that.
Yeah, I was going to say, how do they know?
So they look at the documentation from the providers, from the doctors and so on. It's of course we have to document everything in an appropriate and correct and legal way. And that's
No,
very
what we meant was who's monitoring how long you've been trying for.
Right.
Oh, it's a good point, isn't it? Good
And
point.
it's an important thing to know going in. And once again, here we are talking about arming yourself with knowledge before you go to bat.
Exactly.
Because if you know these answers, you can maybe provide a better story about what you need.
The other thing that we see quite often is for same-sex couples. You know, so clearly, if you are, for instance, in a same-sex female couple, you have, and this is the definition of infertility. This has been changed in the past year, year or two. You have male factor infertility. If you're in a female-female couple, you have no sperm in that relationship, right? So you need to use sperm donation to begin to build your family, and that is infertility. You need sperm. Now, in those situations. I see a lot of folks that might they have different thoughts and opinions about how they want to build their family. For instance, they might want one partner is going to provide the eggs and also carry the pregnancy, but sometimes they want to do reciprocal fertility treatment where one person provides the eggs but the other partner carries the pregnancy. And for that in that situation, that first partner has to do IVF to get the eggs out to then be fertilized and then the embryo is transferred into the other partner. Sometimes insurance companies might say, we're not going to pay for that because you have not had, in quotes, sperm exposure for enough months to be able to justify the cost of doing IVF. So they might say that that first partner has to do IUI or insemination using donor sperm for X number of months before they would cover the IVF treatment. They have to prove that they are not able to conceive that way. But that's the opposite of what the couple wants to do. The couple doesn't want to do that. They want the eggs from one partner and the other partner to carry. So it's very difficult to navigate.
I have a question about that. If one partner is providing the eggs, the other partner is carrying them, is there any sort of risk of rejection like there would be in transplant or anything else like that?
It's a great question. The evidence does not support that, no, actually.
Interesting.
There are equivalent pregnancy rates. There's really fascinating stuff. We don't have to get into the biochemistry and the biology of this too
No, it's
much, but
fascinating.
what's really one of the more fascinating things, I think, is that, you know, when you carry a pregnancy, your uterus directs traffic genetically, and turns certain genes on and off. Again, we don't have to get into the details, but basically the uterus tells the pregnancy to basically add hydrogen atoms to certain genes to turn them on and turn them off. And so that's a very interesting, unique, it creates a unique pregnancy and unique baby, so that even though you might be carrying an egg from one person and a sperm for another person for that embryo, you might think, I don't have anything to do with this pregnancy except the carrying part, which is very important, of
But you
course.
do.
But you do, and you're actually shaping that pregnancy in a way that's unique to you. Whereas if that embryo was transferred into another person, that would be a different human being that was born.
Well,
Unbelievable.
and I would think that that would be, in fact, the reason that some same-sex couples want to do it this way, so that it is a baby of both people, a human from both people. That's fascinating. I would talk to you forever about this sort of the medical part of it. The whole LGBTQ versus heterosexual cultures, all of the differences that are here. I think I should give you a closing word, though. Is there something that we haven't asked you that you would like to discuss before we go?
I would encourage folks that are interested in building their families to talk to a fertility specialist earlier rather than later. Especially if it's been 6 months, a year, you're trying on your own. The worst case is that you do an evaluation and you find something that's, well, okay, everything's okay. You can keep trying a little bit longer. That's fine. At least you know about it. Part of our job is to empower people to make decisions about their lives. Just like that's your job, is you empower people to make financial decisions.
That's
Part of my
right.
job is to empower people to make fertility and reproductive decisions. And if you find something that you can act on, which is many times we can act on things that we find, it's like, okay, at least we know about it, and now we can make some changes and assist with this. Not all fertility treatment is, super high level fertility treatment like IVF. Most people don't do high level fertility treatment. They do much lower, mellow things to improve the chances on a month-to-month basis. So I would encourage folks to reach out to a fertility specialist to discuss it.
Thank you. Yeah, I would think that even things like diet, alcohol, lifestyle, those things are very easily managed, changed, and probably play a part in this role. And I just want to tell people that just like, anything we talk about, there are always exciting changes coming down the pike, but you can't take advantage of those if you don't gain some knowledge. So I would encourage anybody who's interested in learning more about this to reach out to a fertility expert like Dr. Kucherov and see, just gain some knowledge and see what you need to know in order to take the next step. Don't make it into this enormous, barrier that it's so complicated and so expensive that you won't be able to do it. Just dip your toe in the water and find out a little bit more and then see where that takes you.
Couldn't agree more.
Thank you.
All right, Dr. Francis, can we get your phone number?
Of course, Jess. You can reach us at 413-773-3333.
And you can visit hugyourmoney.com. Dr. Alexander Kucherov, Dr. Ram, thank you so much. We'll be back next week with another edition of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor on WHMP.